Good morning. Robin Puanani Danner, chairman of the Sovereign Councils of the Hawaiian Homeland Assembly, looks at budget goals for the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. And Educational Policy Center Director Jim Shun looks at the governor's goal of transforming education through a more campus-based orientation. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Kathy Kozak in for Beth Ann. First aid for the mental health of our youth in the Department of Education. We'll talk with C.J. Rice of Project AWARE and cancer survivorship support groups that help everyone touched by this disease. We'll talk with Heidi Robinson about the latest.
It's Tuesday, December 27th, and stick with us for the conversation right after the news.
You're listening to The Conversation. I'm Kathy Kozak, here to enjoy the last week of 2016 with you, Chris.
Hey, Kathy, it's good to have you sitting in for Beth Ann for the next few days.
Going to have an exciting look forward to 2017.
Welcome to the show. Few would argue that the Department of Hawaiian Homelands has come anywhere close to succeeding in its mission, or that its latest budget request to the state for $267 million annually had any chance of being met. The governor's budget proposal for DHHL is a far more modest figure, but it's one that Robin Puanani Danner, chairman of the Sovereign Councils of the Hawaiian Homeland Assembly, believes could allow the department to become effective if it's managed properly. He's on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming in. I read a statement by you that's a mixture of optimism and criticism of the current department's management. Is that a fair description?
That's a very fair description.
What are the reasons for optimism?
Well, first of all, the optimism comes from the fact that the governor's budget represents the single highest level of proposed funding in the 95-year history of the Hawaiian Homelands Trust, which was established by Congress back in 1921, even before Hawaii was a state.
Yeah.
Of course, DHHL was formed in 1961 as a result of statehood. So that the optimism is that David Ige, Governor Ige, is many things, but in this budget, he did put in prudent funding in prudent places that we have never seen that kind of placement of funding by any governor. We'll see, though, of course, that this is the governor's proposed budget. We don't know what the legislature is going to do. And so, you know, we have some work to do to bring everybody around and help them feel comfortable.
And in spite of what you just said, it's a fraction of what was requested, and I'm curious as to why such a large number, far more than the department had ever gotten, was requested.
You mean by DHHL or
yes,
by the governor?
Yes, by DHHL, yeah. The $267 million.
Just, it's a real head-scratcher. I know that, from my attempts to speak with them, their request is that they're viewing the world as they need to ask for every penny that is needed, but we define need as everything that's needed but that the department has the capacity to spend. And then, of course, there's always the third criteria, which is what funds are available. We do live in a reality, and there are other needs in the state. So I believe that DHHL's $267 million ask came from a singular view of, let's just put on the table everything we think we need. Doesn't matter whether we have the capacity or the infrastructure organizationally to spend it. Doesn't matter what the resources of of the state really are. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I hope I do. In the past, it has actually left money on the table, right?
Oh my goodness! Just last year, they were authorized to spend just about $75 million, and managed only to spend about $55 million. That's for a year. So, of course, anyone could see that $267 million, that's not going to happen, and that's not going to be success for the people. What we're concerned at with the Shaw, which is homestead leaders across the state, we decided after we saw some of their budget requests that we should put our heads together, sit down, and work on a budget. And most of the homestead leaders that worked on this have been homesteaders longer than most of the staff that work at DHHL.
And yet there doesn't seem to be a lot of communication. You used the phrase earlier, in my attempts to speak with them.
Oh, many, many times. I have tried to contact Bill Isla, who's the deputy, and Joby Masagatani, who is the director, these are the governor's appointees. Our group wanted to sit down with them and lay out what we felt and have a discussion, but we were rebuffed repeatedly.
Well, given that you're stakeholders, obviously stakeholders, Robin, why wouldn't the department want to speak with you?
We like you. Yes, that's what we think. We can't really understand that. We think that there's a lot of knowledge in homestead leaders, and that we have a lot of the solutions. Because again, when administrations change, and they will change, it's us that remains. So we end up being the experts on this trust. So we're very disappointed that this administration doesn't work more closely with the stakeholders.
Well, Robin, let's transport ourselves to an ideal world for a moment, even if it is kind of a fantasy, and say, given the amount proposed, which is in the neighborhood of what, $30 million?
Yeah, all total, the governor has from state funds. The governor is proposing $50 million per year. Which,
okay, let's
which
suppose
we think is something that they can succeed at.
Well, let's suppose that is forthcoming. How would, if you had your druthers, how would that then be deployed?
Well, we would like to see, and in fact, he came very close to what we proposed. Mm-hmm. $20 million of that would be spent on building roads, water, utilities, creating subdivisions on the trust lands, which is an awesome win, not just for Hawaiians, but that's an awesome win for state workers and contractors, because that is putting people to work in building roads and putting electrical lines and water in. So $20 million a year, developing subdivisions so that we can have access to water and start developing affordable housing and putting farms and ranches into play. That we like it a lot.
That's always been the problem, infrastructure, right?
Yes, yes and no. It's the problem is that, and I guess what we're saying and why we agree with the governor here is that money is a problem, but it's not the only problem.
Yeah.
If you have resources, have to be placed in the right location. And so, as I was saying earlier, this $20 million that Governor Ige is proposing into infrastructure, that's a first time.
Mm-hmm.
How's that? That is
wow.
The first time. And that's one of the things that the homesteaders pushed for, is that we'd like to see a respectable level, not too high, because you don't want to have spike spending, right? But we had asked actually for $25 million.
Mm-hmm.
Every year that DHHL can count on to have $25 million a year to be able to keep projects ahead of the land trust in installing that. And that's what makes this so significant. It's not just $20 million. It's $20 million where it's going, in infrastructure.
Yeah.
The other area that the governor set up, we had asked for $3.1 million a year in repair and maintenance, and that's for the aging homestead areas that have repairs. And we asked for $11 million in major repairs. The governor's put in his budget $5 million a year, which you'd think we might be upset about it, but no, actually that's a win, because, again, here is a location of dedicating funding that wasn't being funded ever before. And so he's establishing a $5 million annual allocation toward major repairs and repair and maintenance of existing homesteads. I mean, there are homesteads that are 50 years old that water sewer lines need to be repaired and things of that nature. So once again, modest perhaps by DHHL standards, but in reality, that's major. It's a major and a very prudent investment to put $5 million a year in an area that has been completely ignored.
It does sound, Robin, as if there's reason to hope in spite of it being a very muddled picture. Fair to say?
Yes. Yes, very much so. I mean, when you look at 95 years of a land trust that hasn't been managed very well, sometimes hope's all you have.
Amen.
But in this case, and I'm so very proud of the homestead leaders that brought forward, that had the courage and the willingness to work on something for 6 months to present to the governor. It was the first time ever that citizens of the state, beneficiaries of this land trust, Native Hawaiians, stepped forward and said, "Mr. Governor, this is what we think the annual budget should be." Never been done before. And so I'm really happy to see that the governor at least took their mana'o into consideration and came very close.
Well, Robin, we're going to want to keep an eye on this, and I thank you very much for talking with us this morning.
You have a great week, and
you
Happy
too.
New Year.
Same to you, Robin. Robin Punani Danner is the chairman of the Sovereign Councils of the Hawaiian Homelands Assembly. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:17, and coming up, reaching out to young people in need of mental health care. But first, your quiz.
If you were lucky enough to have some time off for the Christmas holiday, you probably listened to a few tunes at some point. So for today's backyard quiz, we're ruminating on a Don Ho song. The track in question is, "Who Was the Lolo Who Stole My Pakalolo?" It's on Ho's album With All My Love, and the lyrics tell a short story of a marijuana grower. He's upset by a thief who has made off with all of his secret crop. But later, the lyrics change tone when a police officer shows up in response to reports of marijuana cultivation. When the cops search the grower's yard, they don't find a thing. At that point, the grower symbolically thanks the Lolo for stealing his plants, for without him, he would have been charged with a serious crime. For today's backyard quiz, can you name the specific area of Hawaii where the story is set? If you do, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. The first one to get it right gets a prize.
Season's greetings and Happy New Year. This is Virginia Beck from the Public Access Room at the Hawaii State Capitol. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
How'd do you recognize a child that's being bullied, one with depression, isolation, or other mental health issues? What can you do if you see someone who needs help? After growing up in Hawaii and working in education both here and on the mainland, our next guest, Cynthia Rice, understands the importance of everyone being trained in identifying a child in need of assistance. She's the coordinator of Project HI Aware. It's a grant in the Hawaii State Department of Education, and she's here with us this morning. Good morning, CJ.
Good morning. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, everybody wants to be able to help someone out if they understand that someone's in need. But what's so special about identifying youth who might be in crisis? Are we missing this element in what we do every day?
Yes, it's really important because a lot of times when a youth is going through a hard time, they don't even realize that something might be wrong, or they know something's wrong and not sure what to do. And that's why this Project High Aware is a grant. It's a federal grant that the Hawaii Department of Education has. And I'm the coordinator for Youth Mental Health First Aid. So it's a great way to learn and be educated in how to help our youth.
So, like, I'm a physician. I learned to do CPR and, you know, resuscitate people if I'm out in public and there's an emergency. Luckily, that doesn't happen very often. How does your program relate to that?
You know, great example, because I am first aid and CPR certified. And I often look and say, well, Youth Mental Health First Aid now is a certification course throughout the nation. It's something that's not going away. It's something very important, just like being first aid and CPR certified for health. It's important for mental health. And I often say, like, if I'm walking down the street and by the bus stop, how often do I see a youth that needs first aid where maybe their arm is broken, they need a splint? Or how often do I see a youth sitting at the bus stop that might be showing signs of anxiety or signs of depression or an issue happening? That's an important first aid as a first aider to be able to help that youth and know how to approach the youth, know what signs and symptoms to see.
Well, and to be honest, you would see that more than you would see someone needing a splint, I would imagine.
Exactly.
So if we look at it statistically, there is a lot more need for having this type of first aid for mental health.
Yes.
Because that's what we see more often. I think studies have shown up to 1 in 5 youth actually have some type of issue that's going on in their lives.
Exactly. You think of a classroom of 30 students. You know, there's 6 students there that have issues that they're working through or challenges, and often they're unidentified. So again, us to be aware, if we work with youth or no youth, which is everyone in the state, that to be sensitive to that.
Now, your goal is to train mental health first aid responders.
Yes.
And so this project has been around for a few years. You're using a grant. How many people have you trained so far, and what is your ultimate goal?
Well, it's, you know, just rolled out this year 3 has just started, and we haven't done the youth mental health first aid training until year 2. So 10 months ago, we rolled it out, and we have trained over 850 first aiders in the state of Hawaii on 4 different islands. And the wonderful thing about this is we can train everyone and anyone. It's not just specifically for DOE, although we're training our teachers, special ed teachers, security, administration, office staff in the Department of Education. But we're also training community members, faith-based organizations, Maui Police Department recruits we trained. We're training everyone because we all work with youth. We all are first aiders.
And when you train these people to be able to respond, there are some things you're training them to do. Is there an easy way for people to remember what are the steps that they could take?
Oh, well, that's the wonderful thing. It is an 8-hour course, certification, just like regular first aid. The certification's good for 3 years, offered free through the grant, which is wonderful, rather than having to pay over $100 to get trained. It's offered free, and we go over how to see signs and symptoms of youth in need in regular situations, but also suicidal crisis or other crisis situations. And the nice thing is The course gives a wonderful protocol. It's called ALGEE, A-L-G-E-E, and it goes over how to assess for risk of suicide or harm, listen non-judgmentally, give that reassurance and information to the youth, encourage appropriate professional help, because often we don't know what the resources are. And so this trains you in those resources and offering self-help and other support strategies. Because think about the holidays now. We have youth, we think of our nieces and nephews, our own children, neighborhood youth that we've seen grown up. And it's important for us to recognize if life is becoming a little harder for them.
Well, and the idea being that if you can recognize it, you can help hook them up with some resources. You're becoming the first aid responder. You don't have to feel like you're out there trying to fix this alone.
Exactly. You're not there to diagnose or anything. We're just there to become aware, to notice the signs and symptoms when a youth might be well and everything's going fine and then maybe not so fine. And if they're having difficulty with their quality of life or everyday activities, and how to recognize that from, you know, regular adolescent behavior or child behavior, and then being able to get them the resources and help.
Now, when the grant is completed, and that will be in another couple of years, you still have all of these people training. Will they be able to make this program stay alive and be sustainable in the future?
That's a great, great question, because my objective is sustainability, because it's like regular first aid. It's not going away. The certification is really important. So we have instructors. Actually, I'm training instructors throughout the state on all the different islands. We have Department of Education instructors. We have DOH. We have community members. So that way, when the grant ends, we still have instructors in the community training first aiders. Our goal is we're going to have over 3,000 trained in the next couple of years and just continue on from there.
Well, and that's really what makes it sustainable, what makes it something that we'll be able to start now, plant the seeds, and see come to fruition as time goes on. Thank you for telling us about it today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on the show.
CJ Rice is the coordinator for Project HI Aware grant in the Hawaii State Department of Education. She's in charge of coordinating youth mental health first aid and has a national certification program that's being offered free through the grant, trains individuals how to recognize the signs and symptoms of youth who may be dealing with a mental health crisis or challenge. More information is available on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
I need somebody. Not just anybody. Help. You know I need someone. Help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. But now these days are gone, days I'm not so self-assured. Now I find a change of mind.
Think of how often you turn to Hawaii Public Radio for music, culture, and companionship. The station has been here for every day of 2016, and before the year comes to a close, make a tax-deductible gift to support the programming you enjoy. We gratefully acknowledge Jasmine Waipa of Honolulu, Una Somerville of Lahaina, and Garrett Baring of Makawao for their generous support. To support us, you can call 955-8821 during business hours or click Donate to HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Sashimi prices at the end of the year are studied as if they were stock market numbers. As a bellwether of the state of Pacific fisheries, the future of the Hawaii-based longline fleet, and of Hawaii's fishing economy overall. As the industry enters the final year of a three-year agreement and faces further limits on its annual catch, concern is growing over depletion of Big Eye tuna stocks and the effect of future quotas. Chad Blair has that story in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
We obviously are, you know, fisheries are being depleted. Demand is growing. How does that all balance out?
Well, of course, you mentioned stock prices. Definitely this time of year, right? Everybody wants their sashimi, and it's you just wonder whether there's going to come a time when that's just not going to happen. But I know we've all experienced some shortages. But the truth is that the United States, as well as Japan and China and South Korea, are on a quota system. What that means is they actually are limited on how much catch of big eye tuna they can get every year. The U.S. actually reached its quota in July. So how come we're still getting big eye tuna? Well, what we've done and what other nations do is form agreements with other countries in the Pacific that are able to share their stock for a dollar figure. And in our case, it's Guam and the CNMI, right, the Northern Mariana Islands. Mm-hmm. So that's allowed us another 2,000 tons. Well, this agreement, it's a three-year-long agreement, and it does expire next year. The question is, are we going to be able to renew that and continue to catch as much ahi, big eye tuna in particular, as we want to, or whether we're really going to have to take a much harder stand on conservation? Because let's face it, our fish stocks are being depleted globally, and at some point it will not be sustainable unless we can conserve how much fish we consume.
It would seem that it was pretty far from being sustainable already, and that the future would almost inevitably point to declining stocks, wouldn't you think?
Right. And I can tell you that there was a meeting earlier this month in Fiji. Our Nathan Eagle actually attended it. And there was agreement among a lot of countries to have a 10-year rebuilding process of the big eye stocks. And that was something that was welcomed by a number of groups, including the Pew Charitable Trust. Now, having said that, there are others, particularly the fishing industry, and that includes here in Hawaii, that want to catch more fish. Obviously, it's a financial incentive. That is their form of employment, their survival, and they think there are ways to change the system that's in place now to increase their fish catch.
What kind of ways, Chad?
Well, they have this idea of, rather than limiting the catch based on amount, to have a spatial, this is what they call it, a spatial, not special, a spatial management system that you consider where the fish is caught rather than how much. And Westpac, I know that you've heard of that organization.
Sure.
It has jurisdiction around here. It says there's actually a lot more big eye tuna in the northern latitudes near Hawaii compared to towards the equator where most of the fish is caught. So if we could rearrange the system and allow more fish to be caught in these northern latitudes, that should help balance things out. We'll see whether that happens. Westpac is a very powerful lobby, and of course they are representing the industry. That's going to be the big issue, one of many, next year as the stock agreements, rather the quota agreements, run out.
And if something like that rearrangement is done, we've got a year to do it, right?
That's right, exactly. I think summer is in particular going to be important. That's when a new stock assessment comes out. In other words, how much fish are estimated to be out there, particularly the big eye. And that should, of course, influence these discussions.
Well, we'll be thinking of that this New Year's in particular. Thanks, Chad.
Yes. You're welcome, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check with Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair.
Hi, good morning. I'm Brian Panay from the Oahu Nursery Growers Association. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
Governor David Ige has announced ambitious new budget goals for the coming biennium, with promises to encourage innovation, build new facilities, air condition our classrooms, and give schools more local autonomy. Are these goals realistic, and what are the priorities? We ask Jim Sean, director of the Hawaii Educational Policy Center, to weigh in. Jim, is this good news, this budget proposal?
Well, a little extra money here and there is usually good news. Mm-hmm. But I think the perspective is that it's of such a tiny amount. The amount that's going into the weighted formula category of funding, that category is already at $850 million, and we're adding $28 million. Which is a small percentage.
Sure.
$10 million of that will go to children who don't speak English that well, which would, if you did it on a per pupil amount, it would be about $800 for every student of the 12,000 in our system to do that.
Yeah.
But this entire recommendation for that part was actually made by the Board of Ed 18 months ago. So it's not like a new initiative. Mm-hmm. It's good that he accepted their recommendation. But you've got over $36 million added to the DOE just for retirement benefits, for health benefits, for debt on CIP and things, capital improvements and things mm-hmm. like that. So it's basically a budget that kind of keeps up with inflation, with a little nuance here and there for innovation, hopefully, and that's always good. What really will make a difference is whether or not at the school level they have more flexibility and more authority to make decisions. We have a new state plan, and we have a blueprint by Governor Ige's special group that's pushing in that direction. But until the Board of Ed actually changes some of its policies, which is still very top-down, we decide at the top, you implement. Until you do that, it's hard to see, in my view, how this relatively small amount is going to have a huge impact on student learning throughout the system. It's good that he added it, great, but it's a very modest amount. Perspective, last year the teachers proposed an additional $700 million into public ed, so this is significantly less than that.
Sure. Jim, where would that $700 million have gone? You know, that's sort of an ideal, under ideal conditions, right?
Well,
what would it have done?
They had a lot of categories like arts education and things like that, but it would have added to the general fund amount.
Yeah.
And there are a number of reasons why that was probably impractical and not going to fly in terms of adding to the general excise tax and things like that.
Sure.
But that's just a perspective of what this one vested group felt was needed mm-hmm. to infuse. I mean, obviously they want more teacher salaries and things like that. But, you know, $28 million and then it can disappear so quickly if it's not really well targeted. And the hope is that it will be well targeted.
Jim, I want to circle back to a term you used a couple minutes ago, the weighted student formula.
Yes.
Define that for me, if you would.
Well, many years ago, they decided that it would be best to adjust budgets to the schools based on some of their problems or challenges, mm-hmm. The number of students that they might have who don't speak English well, the number of poor students, how rural your school is and small and things like that, mm-hmm. right? So they created a committee on weights, or a COW, and the COWs meet regularly. And it's a very carefully thought-out formula where X amount goes for each pupil in different categories. So not all schools will get the same amount based on the characteristics of their enrollment.
Yeah.
Right now, the weighted student formula represents about 55% of just the general funds. Keep in mind, the board or the department's budget per year is about $2.4 billion. $1.5 billion is just our general funds, mm-hmm. and this is a subset of that. So it is an attempt to intelligently address real needs in real schools that differentiate the schools in their communities. Question is there enough? And even though they add this money to the school, is there real power to decide, or do you have to send a form up the chain of command all the way to the board in some cases to get permission to use those funds the way you would like to?
Is that the case currently?
That is the case currently. And the principals and others, Daryl Galera and the Education Institute and this new Blueprint group, have been pushing very much for more power at the school level. But even that is not to the level that we allow power for the charter schools, for example, which have considerably more authority to manage and mold and adapt and innovate at their own school level.
Are local schools somewhat hamstrung in their ability to do what you just described, innovate, tailor their educational methods to the particular student constituency?
There's much lip service given to innovation and whatnot.
Yeah.
But if you don't add that with money and policy, you really get nothing much more than lip service. People have heard about STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. That's a multidisciplinary involvement. But multidisciplinary is not something that's part of the curriculum at all. And so, you know, if you work as a team to solve a problem, that's the real world. Mm-hmm. But we don't test students that way. If you work as a team on a test, we call that cheating. You know, so that kind of integrating these new ideas, school systems are traditionally very slow to move, kind of an industrial model moving into the information age.
Yeah.
It's going to take time, and it's great that the governor has added money to this flexible category. If it is not followed up with really perceived power, then it may not have the impact that it is hoped.
Jim, we're hearing that, and we've heard from the governor's office, that the professions of the coming decades are really not going to be necessarily the professions that are being taught in schools, that schools are kind of lagging behind the jobs that are going to be out there, the far more technology sector jobs, that kind of thing. Are the schools behind the curve on that?
I think everybody's behind the curve on that, frankly.
Yeah, I have to agree.
But particularly the schools, schools still are delivering in silos of specific subject matter.
Right.
The ability to be facile and flexible and move.
Kind of interdisciplinary. Interdisciplinary.
Well, not only that, but since when do we actually have professions anymore? You know, the average length of teachers being in our system is 10 years. And about half of our schools only have teachers that have been there. About half the teachers have only been there for 5 years. So even the teaching profession is evolving. Like many others, I know of a jazz musician who is now involved with radio. You know, so that kind of flexibility and survivability will be very important for the future.
Well, it always has been, Jim. Thanks very much for coming in.
Glad to be here.
Jim Shawn is the director of the Hawaii Educational Policy Center.
Season's greetings and Happy New Year. This is Chris McKinney, author of The Tattoo and Boy No Good. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. During the American War in Vietnam, I saw some astonishing acts of altruism. This happens here at home, too. Our first responders often risk their lives to help others. When Danny Sayer suffered a fatal fall from a cliff, rescuers had to maneuver their helicopters through a tight canyon with barely enough room for the rotors so they could reach his body. In doing so, they placed themselves in jeopardy. How do you say thanks for something like that? Danny's parents, Frank and Laura Mallory Sayer, showed their appreciation by giving the fire department as much needed equipment as possible so they could better serve the community and protect their own lives as well. During the past 20 years, they've raised over $1 million for needed gear for the Hawaii County Fire Department. Because of this generosity, our first responders are better equipped to do their job. And who knows, you may be the next person they rescue. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
In this morning's Backyard Quiz, we asked you about a comedic song written by Don Ho. Who Was the Lolo Who Stole My Pacololo tells the story of a marijuana grower who's upset when a thief steals all his secret plants. After being raided by the police for suspected weed cultivation, the grower changes his opinion of the Lolo and acknowledges he was the only reason the grower avoided arrest. In the song, Don Ho sets the story in a specific area of Hawaii, and today we asked you to name the area. But if you live in Manoa Valley on Oahu, you probably knew this one. If not, well, now you know that Manoa Valley is the answer.
Well, and we heard from Robert Frost in Honaka'a. He knew the answer. It's now 8:48, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Who is the lolo who stole my pakalolo? I saw it in the yard only yesterday. Today when I came home, I found it was gone.
The moment someone is diagnosed with cancer, their world stops as they know it. Tests, treatments, the entire process can be overwhelming. But for those who have already been down that route, they have a lot to share, both inspiring stories and also words of wisdom on how to handle some of the day-to-day changes that are about to happen. As more and more people survive cancer, having a source of group support is an essential part of any cancer treatment plan. Heidi Robinson is in the studio here to tell us more about how this special group of survivors gather together to help others dealing with cancer as well. Heidi, welcome to the conversation.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, how important is a survivorship group to helping those who are going through treatments and also helping those who have been through this already?
Right. So a support group is very essential when you have a cancer center, when you have patients who are diagnosed with cancer. Their world is pretty much instantly turned upside down. Basically, historically, the focus has been on diagnosing a patient, treatment. But over the past decade or so, survivorship has been more of a focus, meaning that after the patient is done with treatment, they're in remission, and they kind of have to figure out their new normal, which is not normal for them still. So having a support group, having people there to talk to get advice, psychosocial, all different areas, it's really important to have that support group there for patients, for their family, for caregivers, and for patients who are actively being treated, as well as people who have survived their cancer.
So this is a group not just specifically of those who have had treatments and survived, but really welcome to anyone touched by cancer in their loved ones, in their families, and those who are actively undergoing treatment. You know, often I find that some of the best advice that people will get will be from other people who have had that happen to them, or they figured out a special way that they can use certain medications or certain types of foods or certain types of nutrition or other elements to really help themselves go through the process. This is kind of a way to sort of connect up, you know, maybe even almost mentor people who are going through similar crises in their own lives.
Absolutely. And I found many times that when patients are diagnosed with cancer, they're just like you and I. They work, they're mothers, they're wives, they have different titles other than just a patient. So when they're going through this, even though they have their family support, even though they have loved ones surrounding them, they still feel alone in the sense of they're the only ones physically going through this. So to have your caregiver, whether it's your spouse, whether it's your mother, a dear friend, someone who's there with you who has a different perspective than they have, because sometimes it's really hard to see really what's going on around you when you're just focusing on almost like survival mode. You have all these tests and all these appointments, and it's really when you get through it, you're able to step back and you have a little bit a different perspective on it. And I think that's when the support group really kicks in, because you're able to actually process what you just went through, instead of just kind of survival mode as you're going through treatment and tests and whatnot.
Well, and I think the key is for those people who have gone through this process, mm-hmm. like you said, when you look back, you can kind of see where all these pieces fit together. And you may have a perspective that could be so valuable to help someone who's looking at this overwhelming situation in their lives and says, I don't even know where to start. Sometimes just having that perspective of, okay, so this is what happened to me. This is how I handled the following challenges can really help someone to feel like, okay, it is normal that this happens. It is okay that, you know, I have to do repeat scans or I have to do all these different things. Or sometimes something as simple as, yeah, I had that side effect when I did that scan too, you know, makes it seem more normal.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it is really good to talk to other people who went through it, who got through it. And like you said, little tips or helpful hints as far as when you go through chemotherapy, what to do with nausea or kind of beating fatigue, you know, all the way to, you know, some of the symptoms where you have peripheral neuropathy, which is the numbness and tingling in your fingers and toes. A patient who went through that could absolutely tell someone else going through it tips and treat and things, how to get through it better and how to deal with it.
Well, and even just saying, I understand. Exactly. I've had that. Here's what happens. Mm-hmm. It gets better, or here's how I've learned to live with it. Mm-hmm. Just to share that personal perspective, I think, can really make a difference. Now, there's all sorts of online support groups, and that's definitely of value. Mm-hmm. Do you find that there's something special about the in-person?
I do. I feel like it's a little more personal. I know it's great to have online options, and it's great to have the social media, but I personally feel in a one-to-one situation, it's a little more personal. Having cancer and going through that sort of treatment is extremely personal. It leaves a patient feeling extremely vulnerable and just really not knowing who they can go to. So having that one-on-one, I think, is very important, and that's what you can find in a support group.
Now, there are several hospitals throughout the island who
Correct.
Have all sponsored and have active support groups.
Mm-hmm.
There are some that you know of on some of the neighbor islands. These are all particularly associated with a hospital or a place where you would get cancer treatment?
Yes. So Straub Medical Center is going to be providing the support group. It's going to be the last Wednesday of every month at Straub Clinic and Hospital. And then I also know that Kauai has a support group as well. And I know that on the Big Island, Kona Community Hospital also hosts a support group. So there's definitely support group in the neighbor islands as well.
And also, there's other hospitals here in Oahu, I think. Queens has a support group.
Yep.
Polymomi has
Correct.
A support group. Really, if somebody is that interested in finding out more information, mm-hmm. they can talk to their oncologist. Is that how all this transpires?
Absolutely. They can talk to their oncologist. They can. You can always, of course, go online. And HawaiiPacificHealth.org covers the Straub, Polymomi, Wilcox, as well as Kapiolani. So all that information is on the website as well.
And you could go to any support group. It doesn't have to be where you get your treatments.
Exactly, yes. You can just find a support group to find something that helps you get through it that really can, I think, can be such a positive influence on your whole cancer journey. So.
Well, and that's really the idea, is if you're struggling with some serious medical illness, what can we do to help you
mm-hmm.
so that you can get through this?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the best person to help you may not necessarily be all your treating doctors. It might be somebody else along the way.
Exactly.
Thanks for coming in and joining us today. Heidi Robinson is a nurse navigator and care coordinator and is leading the survivorship support group at Straub Clinic and Hospital. More information can be available on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Well, Kathy Kozak is joining us this week. And, Kathy, you bring a unique combination of skills when you come in, your medical profession background, but also your background in the arts.
Well, and we're going to talk a little bit throughout this week about some of these unique things we'll hear from other musicians. And it's a great challenge. Adds a little fun to the day.
You still play violin in community orchestras?
I do my best.
All right. Well, that's it for today. And up tomorrow, we'll sit down with our friend Vic Kraft to look at veterans' issues pending in 2017.
Plus, talking with former Professor Robert Lippman about playing music with friends with an eclectic instrumental collaboration.
And as always, we like to hear from you. You can call us at our talkback line, leave your comments there. Be sure to tell us when you do that where you're calling from. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. If you want to email us, you can do that at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Comments can be posted on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, Twitter messages at HI Conversation, or you can reach Beth Ann at BKOZHPR.
If you've missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on our conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Kathy Kozak.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Meet us in the morning for more of The Conversation.